All right, brothers and sisters, I'm back. Now we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in America with this new administration. Mr. Trump is filled with surrounded himself with all kinds of crazed right-wingers, and one of them actually proclaimed he would not campaign for Mr. Trump. His name is Paul Ryan. He is the Speaker of the House, a deeply unprincipled human specimen. And I say that because he tried to play he got all indignant when Hillary and the media came out with all this business about Trump grabbing people's body parts and talking all this foolishness. If you remember, the Democrats, particularly Hillary Clinton, do not want to discuss the actual issues that affect the American people. So what the tactic that they tried to use is an old term called argument ad hominem, argument to the man. They insulted him, they talked shit about him, and they thought that they could distract the attention of the American people away from the fact that, let's say, Hillary Clinton has referred to the TPP as the gold standard of trade compacts. That's what she said. She's on YouTube saying that. Brothers and sisters, she denied saying that in a debate between herself and Mr. Trump on national television. I couldn't believe it. I actually couldn't believe it. But that shows you the contempt that she and the Democrats, and the Democrats that control the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders is not a liar. I don't agree with him. I did not vote for him. I voted for the Peace and Freedom Party candidate. But I have noticed that Bernie Sanders does not seem to be in contempt of the American. He doesn't hold American people in contempt. He doesn't lie every word out of his damn mouth. You know, he was against the TPP. He said it. His proselytizing against the TPP led to Hillary saying that she was against the TPP. Well, of course, she's an unprincipled human specimen. She'll say anything for power. Now, Paul Ryan, another one of those unprincipled human specimens, American politicians are at their worst, just announced his plans to phase out Medicare with privatization using vouchers. Get this. Talking Points memo. Last night, after most were to be published, this brief stunning announcement. And here we go. That's what, you know, one has to control oneself. Because the anger that you feel when you know one of the good things about this country is that we do have Medicare. And if anything, Mr. Bernie Sanders, and I agree with Bernie Sanders on this, we are for single payer. I am for single payer. Every American should be able to go to the doctor when they're sick. I'm not trying to be real personal myself, but I'm ill right now. I'm here due to commitment. But, you know, people have to go to the doctor, man. Sometimes you need help. People don't go to the doctor because they can't. That's why they don't go. Free medical care for all. Single payer is what we need. Paul Ryan just announced that as part of repealing Obamacare, he plans to phase out Medicare and replace it with private insurance for retirees. Republicans for years, and especially Paul Ryan, has floated this plan. He's a Tea Partier, to let you know, to privatize Medicare, and now he may get his way if we don't fight back. New York Magazine has explained. Okay, now I'm going to move up here and talk about why we must not be frightened of people like Mr. Paul Ryan, like Mr. Trump. We mustn't be frightened of anyone. What we want to do is be prepared. And if we're prepared and we understand what's going on, we know how to fight back. So during this case, you should know, first of all, there's a contradiction that we should exploit. because during his campaign, Mr. Donald Trump often promised to be a different kind of Republican, one who would represent the interests of the working class voters who depend on major government programs. And he said, and this is a quote from Donald Trump, he said, "I'm not going to cut Social Security like every other Republican. I'm not going to cut Medicaid or Medi-Cal or Medicare or Medicaid," he declared, under the headline, "Why Donald Trump Won't Touch Your Entitlements." That's what he said. Okay? I see a difference between what Donald Trump said and what Mr. Paul Ryan is saying. Now, I had a debate with a fellow worker the other day who supported Trump. His name is Chuck. Decent guy, white fella. No, he is not a deplorable. He is not something that's from another planet. He's an American that believes Trump, and he voted for Trump. And you know what? You know what Chuck told me? Chuck said, "Look, Trump's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. He got rid of all of those rotten politicians and all those lobbyists out of his transition team. He expelled them. So he's going to do the right thing." Well, that's what Chuck thinks. What's going to happen remains to be seen. We must be intelligent and vigilant and see. Well, some people think that Trump was lying. I am one of them, okay? The transition team's point man advocates privatization, but then they got rid of that point man. So because of the instability of him choosing his transition team, it's hard to predict. I don't use a crystal ball. I have to look at reality and see what's actually happening. But here's the point that I'm trying to make to you. It is not going to be very easy for Mr. Trump to kill Obamacare. In fact, if you notice, Mr. Trump went to the White House and met with Obama. They shook hands, embraced, and all of that, so they could have a peaceful transition from president to president. And even then, Trump said, "Okay, well, I'm not going to be able to get rid of all of Obamacare." He said that. So he says one thing to incite what some of the black community calls the poor white or the Peckerwood base and get you all worked up. But then, when in reality, he realizes he can't change everything in one swift, you know. And in fact, the base, Trump's base of white working class people are dependent on Medicare. Those people voted for him. Do you think if he turns around and starts to attack Medicare and Social Security right now, what do you think is the most likely response? Don't be fooled. I'm going to move ahead to Mr. Mark Zuckerman's dilemma. And that is, something's wrong with Facebook. Now, I have to tell you, I have a Facebook account. I think I've used it twice. So I'm not a Facebook person. I don't know all. That's why I learned from this crisis of what's happening. Donald Trump's supporters were probably heartened in September when, according to an article shared nearly a million times on Facebook, the candidate received an endorsement from Pope Francis. Their opinions on Hillary Clinton may have soured even further after reading a Denver Guardian article that also spread widely on Facebook, which reported days before the election that the FBI agent suspected of involvement in leaking Ms. Clinton's emails was found dead due to a murder-suicide. The Pope supports Trump. Hillary's a hitman. There's just one problem with these articles, brothers and sisters. They're completely fake. The Pope, a vociferous advocate for refugees, never endorsed anyone. The Denver Guardian doesn't exist. Yet, thanks to Facebook, both of these articles were sent by potentially millions of people who forwarded them unknowingly to their friends. Actually, 40 million times. 40 million times. Although corrections also circulated in the social network, they barely registered compared with the reach of the original fabrications. This is not an anomaly. We encountered such fake stories last year on social media, and so did the American voters, 44% of whom use Facebook to get their news. Mark, and why? Because we don't trust the media. The head-fixing industry deserves our scorn. They deserve our distrust. But you have to, I don't know, God, let me shut the hell up. I don't know what to do. What do you do? Where can you get your news from? There's no authoritative central authority that I can say is right. I was just denounced by a fellow Panther. Oh, I'm sorry. We are veterans of the Panthers. I'm no longer a member of the Panthers. Panthers don't exist. So I have to be careful with that. My brother Larry Pinckney and I had an ugly argument about this article I'm sharing with you now, because he says, well, you should never cite the New York Times. Brothers and sisters, I'm not citing the New York Times as much as I'm sharing information in the Times, which I believe is pretty much accurate, which is an opinion piece by a professor who studies media. And this critic, I think, has raised some interesting points. So I am not passing on a fake story right now. The New York Times has to be read critically. That's true. But we cannot run away from the national paper of record when sharing vital information with our brothers and sisters. So I just want you to know, this opinion piece was in the Times. I am simply gleaning the facts from it that I think you need to have. So Mr. Zuckerberg, just to let you know, is the owner of Facebook. And he believes that it is a pretty, he said, this is a quote from him, a crazy idea that, quote, fake news on Facebook, which is a very small amount of content, influenced the election in any way, unquote. He's wrong. He's in denial. It does influence people. The majority of the young people look to things like social media and Facebook. Why? Because they don't trust the corporate media. And they're right. They are right. The corporate media manipulates and lies daily. So what is all of this about then? Well, what's really happening here is they're attacking social media because of the greed of Mr. Zuckerman and Google. And see, they want to make money. All right, let me see if I can explain it in everyday language. How does Zuckerman make billions of dollars with Facebook? What the hell? I thought you put up a message, you give it to your friends, they send it to their friends, and that's Facebook. Wrong. Facebook sells advertisement space, and so does Google. So Google has the nerve. I never asked for this, but every day they send me a little message that says, we got some great news stories for you. And I just delete it and move on, because I'm not into Google to where I would want to read their choice of news stories. But here's why it's important to delete it and move on. They accept these news stories based on what's called an algorithm. I know it's a big word. I don't hardly know what it means. But what it means is this. It's a mathematical calculation as to how many people are likely to read this based on. And who gives them this algorithm? People that make money taking money from these false news sources. It's very complicated. It's very sad. But brothers and sisters, we have to wade our way through this manure in order to find the truth. Just know, don't read those silly suggested news pieces that Google and Facebook provide to you. I can't get into it anymore because, boy, I could talk about it for another hour, but we've got a program for you today. A program that I think you're going to really enjoy. We have in the studio with us brother Michael Goldstein, a lawyer and an activist, and a member of the Oscar Grant Committee, I might remind you. So, We're going to go to a nice song here to give us the feel of what we're going to be talking about today. I told you today's theme is Standing Rock. Give me a minute. I'll be right with you. day, brothers and sisters. Now, right now, I'm pleased to have Brother Michael Goldstein, who is both a lawyer. No, both. That's the wrong word. Demands a lot of things. He's a lawyer. He's an activist. And he is an author. I just want to let you know that he has written a book called Return of the Light. This book is available on The Printed Voice, it's called, is the publisher. And it's a political fable in which the American people retake their country. Whoa! Hold on a minute. I need some of that. I need that. It is the night of the winter solstice in 2120. At one of the thousands of community gatherings across the United States, a storyteller begins the annual retelling of how back in 2023. Wow. Okay, hold on a minute. The book, the people took over their own government, making it a means for mobilizing their collective power to promote peace, social justice, environmental responsibility, and a society hospitable to the needs of the human spirit. This sounds kind of interesting, buddy. What the hell are you talking about?
What am I talking about? Hey, you didn't tell me I'd be talking about this, Gerald.
Well, a little.
Well, okay, what I'm talking about is that, you know, long before we were faced with a choice primarily between Hillary and Trump, it was clear to me that the teeter-totter, the Tea-Party system, is a distraction, and each side promises to meet the needs of the vast majority of the American people, but each side is funded by, 1% of the 1% primarily, and they have to serve whom they have to serve. So, this book is a, you know, if you talk about a real revolution in this country, particularly one where the movement for it is based in nonviolence, people see it as, yeah, maybe we need that, but it's pretty utopian. And so by writing this book from the future, looking back on going through all the areas of public policy that showed why it needed to happen, the things we've gotten used to as frogs in the pot, and then telling the story of how the people got it together, you know, not in one election cycle, but over a period of years with a consistent strategy to build an organization, to organize and educate the people as we engaged in all the different struggles we had to, that finally a movement was built that in a particular crisis, when millions of people took the streets, the old government fell like they have all over the world, and a new one was formed. So it's making it real by presenting a scenario of how it could happen from a future in which it already has. And, you know, the few people who've read it are very heartened by it.
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't want to hear that few people stuff, because you're not the only person who has self-authored a book. The volume itself is very professional. The cover is beautiful. This is something that millions could read. The point is, we don't control the distribution of knowledge in this society. So guess what? Maybe we have to respect each other. Maybe we have to help each other. Maybe we have to have confidence in each other. We can do this. That we can do. They can't take that away from us. So we can do that. And now, I'm going to make it my business. I'm going to have to read this thing, because you know why? I love knowledge. I love it. And I can tell you already, there is a tradition, even in this country, for books like this. I'll give you an example. The Iron Heel by Jack London. You don't know who you are yet. You don't know how the American people would receive what you bring, because we're being blocked at every turn by the enemy, by the 1%, and their minions, and their media, and confusion, and religion. Sorry. You know, and all of that is stopping the American people from coming together, from becoming a whole people, from becoming themselves. So right now, I'm going to have to pledge myself to look at the damn book, and we're going to come back and really discuss the process. How do you put something? I'm gonna compare it to that masterpiece, The Iron Heel. We'll look at that too, and we'll have a really enriched discussion about the matter. But right now, the reason we got Mike here, well, it's twofold. As I told you, he's a lawyer and he's an activist. So we're going to start off with the lawyer. Recently, you know, well, we passed the marijuana thing. Hey! That's right. But unfortunately, Proposition 62 lost, and Proposition 66 won. Now, I'm going to give you my little limited make on it, because I don't know a lot, but I'm going to share. Proposition 62 was put forward as a substitute for the death penalty. It was argued that we need to get rid of the death penalty. Why? Because it's too expensive, they said. Well, that was a big mistake. That was death penalty focus, their misleadership. It's not a question, in my opinion, it is not a question of how expensive it is, because it can always be made cheaper. And that's what the Proposition 66 people said. They said, hey, if it costs too much, here, let's just get rid of the good lawyers. Let's deny the prisoners, those who are convicted of the death penalty, the right to choose counsel. Hey, Eric, I got $5,000 for you, man. You want to take a death penalty case? How bad you need the money? Oh, well, come on, man. Don't worry about it. I got you. You got the money. Fuck it. It's all right. It's done. Is that the way people should choose lawyers? I can go out in the street and just take somebody. They don't even have to have a law degree, maybe. Who knows what's going to happen? They could kill 30 to 50 people a month if they wanted to. They have the ugly will, the sickness to do it. The question is, what are we going to do? Mike, give me some guidance here, man. Come on. Help me out. What's going on? What does this mean, 62? Substituting life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for the death penalty, which demoralized a lot of the death penalty people. It didn't demoralize me, because I already knew. Half a loaf is better than none. I voted for 62. I advocated for 62. Because if they're alive, where there's life, there's hope. So I said, no. Support it, and we'll fight the details out later. But groups like, I hate to say this, the International Socialist Organization, among others, took the position that, no, life imprisonment without the possibility of parole is reactionary, and therefore we're not going to support 62. And I begged them. I said, guys, wait a minute. You're making a mistake. Don't kill the good with the perfect. We, you know, and so 66, to tell you the truth, many of us never even read the proposition. All we did was we assumed we vote for 62 for now, and we'd win, and we'd sort it out later. Help us out, Mike.
Well, Gerald, I'm right with you on 62, both that there might have been better strategies for promoting it, but also that that stopping killing people who are on death row is a good thing, even if they're going to be in prison for the rest of their lives. That was the original choice their juries had when deciding sentence anyway. It was between life without parole and the death penalty. And so that was meaning there would be no death sentence. As far as Prop 62, you know, you asked me to research it. I printed out this 7 pages of 5 fine print. I found that the better thing to do was listen to a podcast by an expert on it. And what she was saying certainly fit in with my understanding of how the system works. Basically, Prop 66, people can take a breath and calm down. The bottom line is the quick executions, the five-year limit on how between when someone is sentenced to death and when they would be executed, the execution a week, all those scenarios are trying to think of what I can say on the radio here, but they are the erotic dreams of the hardcore death penalty proponents. It's not something they could make happen by writing a law. For one thing, all that can be controlled by any state law is state procedures. And after a person on death row exhausts their appeals within the state system, they have a right to go to the federal courts with any claims that their federal constitutional rights were violated, which in virtually all cases seems to happen. The federal courts are not set up to process these cases the way the Prop 66 people would like, nor are the state courts for that matter, but I want to keep this short and simple. The statistic I just heard was that 270 of California's capital cases are now in the federal system. The district court, which is the level where they begin in the federal system, has been handling 7 cases a year. If someone loses in district court, well, if either side loses, the state or the person who's been sentenced to death, then there's an appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. They're doing 5 cases a year. They're not staffed to handle the California's 700-person death row. So, and those cases take years, and 65% of them are reversed in the federal courts and go back for a new trial anyway. So, the bottom line is, as the person I heard commenting on this said, it's one more of those false promises to those families of murder victims who do believe that an execution will give them a sense of justice and closure, because it's just not going to happen. It's absolutely impossible. And the thing you mentioned, Gerald, about appointing unqualified lawyers in order to meet whatever the incredibly short deadline is for getting lawyers appointed, if that were to happen, which would take God knows how many Trump administrations staffing the judiciary to allow that to be considered consistent with due process and a right not to lose I don't want to get too lawyerly here. Anyway, it's unconstitutional. And if somehow the judiciary reached the point where they weren't seeing that, that would be so many years of litigation down the road. I mean, 66 is going to slow things down because so much of it is going to have to be litigated just to be clarified what it means and what parts, if any of it, are valid. So this one is not worth panicking about.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think I've gotten caught up in the Hillary panic. Yes, I'm human. And listening to you, brother, has at least calmed my spirit a bit. And I understand, and I think I'll have to look into it more, get more of the facts. And I can't thank you enough for coming here and sharing that intelligent, wise assessment. The Constitution still exists despite the twisted wishes of some right wingers. We're gonna move on now and play you a nice little song. Play you a nice little song, and then we're gonna start talking about Standing Rock. Thank you.
And they all can be prepared, have no kind of fear. They all sober them brand new suits, the mass in every year, yeah.
Pounding this down in New Orleans.
We got a bloody caterpillar.
Talk a little bit about Standing Rock. I've got two news items to report on, and then we're gonna return to a discussion with Michael on his sort of perspective and experience with the Standing Rock conflict. So first, a successful action was led in San Francisco on Tuesday that began with an hour-long sunrise prayer. And so what took place there was hundreds. Did either of you hear a figure?
2,000.
2,000 people began to gather around 6:30 in the morning at City Hall in San Francisco. And a number of prayers were led by a number of different indigenous and non-indigenous spiritual and faith traditions. One that stood out to me was a Christian group who led a prayer of repentance for the role of Christianity and Catholicism in colonization. There were Jewish and Islamic prayers and several indigenous prayers to the water and the land, and this was organized by groups who are holding signs that say "Keep the oil in the ground," that say "Water is sacred, water is life." After about an hour of prayer, the group marched down Market Street and held space in front of the Army Corps of Engineers office in San Francisco for about 30 minutes to an hour. Quoting one of the organizers, "It's important that we here in the Bay Area are in solidarity with those out in Standing Rock." So this action was to express solidarity in response to the week of action that was called at the beginning of this week by the leadership at Standing Rock, and to place pressure on the Army Corps of Engineers to make a more formalized decision respecting the indigenous rights to the land. This brings me to another piece of news, which is that on Monday, the Army Corps of Engineers released a statement saying that additional discussion and analysis is needed or is warranted before they can grant an easement that the Dakota Access Pipeline needs to begin constructing on the land near Lake Oahe. The Army Corps statement clearly laid out that construction cannot occur across the land near this lake. Quoting the statement, construction on or under Corps land bordering Lake Oahe cannot occur because the Army has not made a final decision on whether to grant an easement. So this is a small victory. It is not a, it does not formalize or codify protection of the land on any permanent basis, but it strengthens the language. The Army Corps of Engineers has asked the energy transfer partners a number of times to voluntarily cease construction pending their investigation. This time, the Army Corps of Engineers is now insisting that construction cease. The statement on Monday denying an easement comes a week after Dakota Access made an election night statement claiming that, quote, Dakota Access remains confident that it will receive the easement for these two strips of land adjacent to Lake Oahe in a time frame that will not result in any significant delay in processing with drilling activities near Lake Oahe. So in their November 8th statement, Dakota Access also denied the existence of claims made by Army Corps that Dakota Access had agreed to slow down their construction. So what this statement insists also is that the Standing Rock Sioux tribe be consulted on the use of that land. Now, this doesn't guarantee that the tribe's will be respected, but it gives the tribe a formal protection of their input on what happens on this land. So that's where things are now. I'd like to maybe turn the discussion to Joe.
All right.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to some critical remarks that I heard about the fact that these 2,000 people blocked the entrances and exits of the Army Corps of Engineers building on Market for at least 6 hours, which means that no one went in and no one went out for that period of time. Not only is the stuff that Brother Eric just mentioned relevant, because it is a small victory, and we got to have some victories in order to fuel us to continue this fight. So yes, small victories. And what the criticism I heard was, well, it's just symbolic, they stopped it for one day, they're still going to build a pipeline. This is not true. Number one, symbolic victories are victories. We did something. Collective action of 2,000 citizens stopped the Army Corps of Engineers from meeting to let them know, to create pressure, that people are concerned about this. No arrests took place. That is a victory. Small, symbolic, yes, but real. We should not discount the fact that 2,000 people showed up at 6 o'clock in the goddamn morning. I didn't make it. My poor little body can't carry me everywhere. But I was there in spirit, and I am overjoyed that this small victory took place. Now, we're going to listen to Brother Michael Goldstein, who actually went to Standing Rock. I was shocked to hear this. No, because it's not easy to get out there in the damn cold, freezing weather every day to support a living struggle. Mike, once again, glad to have you here.
Thank you, Gerald. And I want to tag on to something you said about Tuesday's show of support in San Francisco, which was that was one action out of
Monday.
Yeah, that was there had been, I didn't know this, we don't always get a whole lot of news at the camp where there isn't the internet and only a little cell phone coverage from one place called Cell Phone Hill or Facebook Hill. But Tuesday was a nationwide day of action, and I read that there were protests and shows of support in at least 100 cities. And, you know, the other way that matters is that word of things like that does make its way back to the camp. There is a sacred fire that's kept going in a central location with sort of a wide open sort of plaza space around it, and a man with a mic making announcements, as well as other people being invited to as well. And when we hear about anything anywhere, that really boosts the spirits of people who are, as you said, braving some pretty harsh conditions. So that said, I want to add that I was as surprised as you were that I went. I had uncharacteristically had five different travels this year that were far enough away that I had to fly, and I'm not a frequent flyer, and when I came back from one in September, I was so glad that I was home and wouldn't have to travel again and could get caught up on a few things. And a friend said to me, you know, given our mutual interest in nonviolent direct action, implicitly or explicitly spiritually grounded, I think you should go to Standing Rock. And I was very sympathetic to Standing Rock, as you know, as well as whatever the 30 other issues that are high on the agenda of any of us who see what's happening and care about it. But I thought she was crazy and sort of made this sign that you do with your fingers to ward off a vampire. But it was like, I don't want to hear this talk. I don't like cold, and I'm done traveling. And you know, what's one more body they're going to do? But I respect my friend enough that I said, you know, okay, I will meditate about it and ask spirit or my higher power for guidance. And I procrastinated about that for a couple of weeks. But when I finally, you know, was literally sitting down to do my meditation where I can seek guidance, as I'm sitting down, I sort of like felt in my bones, you're going, you know, you're going. And even now I choke up a little to remember that and remember my willingness to go along with it. So that's a little part of my personal journey with this whole thing. And I had a round trip ticket to come back in 8 days, and I ended up staying for 3 weeks, basically for the same reason. It was just spirit was telling me, you know, it's not time to go yet. So what I'd like to do is talk some about the community and some about the struggle. And as I was contemplating my time with you earlier this morning, I felt that the first thing that I really want your listeners to know, I don't know your audience that well, but I know a lot of us activists, including myself, even though I've come around to seeking a spiritual way of life in the last some years, there's a way in which I can divorce activism from spirituality. And the place I want to start was the aspect of being in that environment with that community that feels different from other kinds of activism. I'm guessing that the circles around the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Martin Luther King experienced a lot of this in the 60s, but I have not before. There were plenty of opportunities to listen to elders, both from the Standing Rock tribe and from other nations that came as allies, both lead prayers and talk philosophically about what it was we were doing. And one of the things they said, and I started actually being able to feel, was this sense of isolation, of being separate atoms, each of us as individuals, disconnected from anything larger, and therefore having huge responsibilities on our shoulders to make things happen when we see a need to make changes in the world. Something was coming through beyond that. People spoke of how the ancestors are present and supporting us, of how the future beings know what we're doing and need us. And all this, you know, from the perspective of the people I'm relating, you know, all this is happening in this moment. What's different about us is that we have bodies to act, and the ancestors are no longer in their bodies, the future beings are not yet in their bodies, but there is this whole collectivity that goes backwards and forwards in what we think of as time, and that includes Mother Earth and what folks referred to as the two-leggeds and four-leggeds and the winged ones and those who swim and those who burrow. And as humans, we're in the, as I said, in the unique position of being able to act, but we're not alone. We're part of a much larger process, perhaps a benevolent one, and certainly one that can be grounded in love and power. And related to that, one of the more powerful ideas I heard expressed a few times was that the resistance that the Standing Rock Nation and its allies have mounted against this particular pipeline, which threatens, you know, one actually very large water supply. It's the beginning of the Missouri, which goes into the Mississippi. But that this particular action is not the be-all and the end-all, that there were many struggles before this, both to protect the earth and certainly to protect the survival of native peoples, and that there will be plenty after this one. Whether this one fails in traditional terms or succeeds in traditional terms, it's part of something that's very much ongoing.
I want to play a song now that hopefully will help people understand partially what we're talking about here. It's called Sacred Ground by the Neville Brothers. I'm coming right at you.
Grows on this sacred ground. vibrations. I hear their voices on the wind. All my relations, they have danced on sacred ground. The spirits of my ancestors
So I was telling your listeners, Gerald, a little bit about the environment and feeling there, but without being real specific about what I saw. And I, you know, I saw a lot in the kind of what the camp was like, which I'd like to take some time to tell your listeners about, and also, you know, when I first hit the ground, I also saw a lot of and heard a lot about the law enforcement response, which I'm sure some people know about. The Morton County Sheriff's Office in North Dakota has been extremely overreactive, brutal, doing a with a militarized response, and actually seeing that firsthand was a bit shocking. The first full day I was there, I worked as a legal observer on Highway 1806, which is the main road. It's only two lanes, but for rural North Dakota, a main road going south from Bismarck and actually goes to camp. On October 27th, one of the what were then three main camps at Standing Rock, the one that was called the 1851 Treaty Camp, which was on land that should still belong to the Standing Rock, or at least the Great Sioux Nation, because of their treaty rights. but was now private property and had been sold to the pipeline company. An encampment had been built on that. It was called the Treaty Camp. There were other names for it as well. And on the 27th, that camp was forcibly cleared by the sheriff's office, the National Guard, and officers and troops from I don't know how many other agencies that they got mutual aid from. So I didn't see the clearing of the camp, although I heard stories about it. But where I was on the road outside of it, where the authorities were slowly pushing people south. And on the one hand, it seemed like there was a fair amount of restraint, because for close to 4 hours, they were making announcements saying, you need to go south, you need to go back to camp. And their line of troopers was only advancing, you know, a couple of feet every few minutes as the crowd of supporters on the highway would retreat a couple of feet every few minutes. That was sort of the good news about the law enforcement response. The bad news was that besides a surveillance aircraft overhead and a helicopter, there were 5 Humvees, a couple in front of us, and the other 3 in fields off to the side. These looked like these are not your Hummers that you see on the road here. These looked like they came straight out of Afghanistan, Gerald. They were sand-colored. They had, I'm gesturing with my hands as if we were on TV, they had these big vertical but angled armored plates coming up from the chassis and going overhead. And they had a gun, a long-range rifle on a swivel mount in the back. In addition, I don't even know what these other vehicles were. There were 2 others that were the size of very large dump trucks that sort of looked like the Humvees, but, you know, on a much larger scale. Besides the gunner in the back, they had gun turrets on top like a tank does. These were all staffed. I can probably say manned, because it probably was men. At one point, someone among us yelled sniper and pointed off to the left, where maybe 150 yards away there was a man lying prone in the grass facing us, certainly in the position of a rifleman. I, as a legal observer, I had a pair of binoculars, so I looked. There was tall grass. I couldn't see whether or not he was armed, but it looked that way. But what I did see was that in the Humvee next to him, Gerald, remind me of the things I'm not supposed to say on the radio. The man of not very high consciousness who was handling the gun in the back of the Humvee swung it around and pointed it at me. And this was from 150 yards away, so I didn't freak out until the next day when I was writing about it on social media.
A part of what's happening today is there has been an intentional militarization of the police. We have talked about this situation on this program, particularly right here in Oakland. The militarization of the police is taking place apace. And we've talked about the case of Omar Shakur, who is, you know, still they have not dropped the charges against him, even though they raided the wrong house on July the 25th. They raided the wrong house. They placed bombs in the front and back of the house. There were snipers present. We have this all on video. This is not empty talk. And they have still, the city of Oakland has not dropped the charges against him. They intend to utilize this militarized police force to cow and terrorize the population. So this is not surprising. This is the new dispensation. We have to fight this. They don't need these tanks. They shouldn't be using tanks on American citizens, drones on American citizens. We have the right to protest, and we will continue to assert that right. And one of the things that I'm so proud of in terms of these Indians is their courage. I saw a man on television with an AR-15. This is a machine gun. This is an automatic weapon, working his way into the demonstration. He was surrounded by Native Americans who forced him back. These people had no weapons. He had an AR-15, and they surrounded him and forced him back. I saw one brother pick up a stick. A stick! The courage, you can't measure courage like that. Please continue.
So this was actually that same day. I didn't see that incident, but I was there when it happened. The camp clearing itself, from what I heard about it from eyewitnesses and people who were affected by it, was sort of a similar contradiction. There were stories of discipline and restraint upon the part of officers. There were also either officers or DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline, security people who were allowed to act this way by officers, who did things like seize a sacred pipe that was being used in a prayer ceremony and break it in half.
Provocation.
Slash people's tents, bulldoze stuff to the pipeline company later bulldozed some of the stuff to the center. I personally hung out for quite a while with an older man who came into the legal tent with his prayer staff, which was a stick about close to 6 feet tall, sharpened on the end, varnished very nice, and with a few feathers hanging from the top. And my colleague asked him, "Are you okay?" And he said no, and doubled up in emotional pain, his face down to his knees, just sobbing. He kept saying over and over, "They destroyed my medicine, they destroyed my medicine." What that meant was that a 1,200-year-old sacred whistle, ceremonial whistle, that had been handed down from generations and been given to him as a very meaningful gift, had been taken away from him and disposed of in some way. That the staff that I saw, each one of the feathers on it had a meaning and a history and came from a particular shaman or a particular place. They had, one of those feathers was mutilated, and he told me they had torn off and thrown away four or five others. And he showed me what was his medicine bundle, which was now just a piece of open red cloth, because in his presence they had opened it up and scattered the contents to the wind. And I can't tell you how crushed this man was. I ended up sitting there crying with him. It was just very, very sad, and it's hard to take in what can happen to the human spirit to make people do stuff like that. And I need to say at the same time that there were at least a couple of officers who turned in their badges the next week, that there were people at the camp that was cleared who saw other officers standing to the side a little bit, hanging their heads and crying. So it's not just one thing.
No, but you see, what that shows you is that America is not a homogeneous place where everyone feels the same about everything. Even law enforcement knows that some of this, the people that participate in law enforcement know what the Constitution is, know what human decency is, and resent what they're being forced to do.
So that's a good segue into the fact that the camp was not homogenous either. Everyone was requested to attend a 2-hour nonviolent direct action training before going on any actions. And there were like 11 agreements that we were asked to adhere to, including the one, we are peaceful and prayerful. Another, this is a ceremony, please act accordingly. And there was much of what happened both in camp and when people went up to the front lines was, you know, exactly within those principles. But there were also people, particularly, you know, disproportionately non-Native allies, whose idea of effective protest was to shout taunts at the police. And you know, I was particularly uncomfortable with this because I felt that as guests and allies, it wasn't our role to be changing the tone of the demonstrations or the water protection activities. And also, you know, Gerald, because of what we were just both observing a moment ago, my belief is that if you do show up, I mean, it doesn't have to be prayerful if that's not your thing. In the, you know, in the anti-war movement, a lot of times it was people, hippies, putting flowers in the muzzles of officers' guns. But if you show up peaceful and treating the people on the other side of the visor or badge or uniform as a human being, and you don't know where they're coming from, then eventually their ranks can be split. Whereas, you know, if we're throwing stuff at them or shaming them, they're going to close ranks.
Look, I want to tell you something. Unfortunately, we have lost through death, as you say, people have become ancestors, and the fact that people are not well educated in this country about the history of the social movements that have preceded us. I have some experience in the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, and I can just tell you that very often people don't know what the word support means. When you come to support people, that means that you get in where you can fit in. And I'm sorry. Look, I'll give you an example. I organize many demonstrations against police brutality, and it is our hope that through these demonstrations we can educate people. Well, I have found repeatedly that many folks, I'm not just anarchists now, let's not use this for anarchist bashing, but anarchists have done this, got specifically very disrespectful to law enforcement, spit at them through vessels with urine in it at the police. Oh, yes. Now, I'm not making this up. This happened. And I agree with what Michael just said, that the intelligent policy is to maintain our dignity, make our point, and through that, it is possible to affect the consciousness of the people that are there to enforce the law and not push them into thinking that, you know, provocations and violence, that we should be mistreated. Yes, we do split them. I want to tell you, here's an example. We had the demonstration about Charlotte, where the police had withheld a tape of the killing of a young man, right? Well, due to mass pressure, they gave up the tape, and we saw it, and sure enough, the police murdered this young man. So I was asked to be kind of the MC of the rally. So my training and experience through Occupy and before is that everyone who wants to speak can speak. So I passed the mic to anyone who wanted to speak. One of the people that wanted to speak was a preacher who believed in nonviolence and also, I think, was relatively conservative, to be honest. And as he went on about how we have to obey the law and all this kind of stuff he was saying, the anarchists who controlled the sound system just turned the thing off. Just turned it off while the guy was speaking. I found this very personally. It was an affront to me. I thought it was an affront to the Black community. Not because I disagreed with the anarchist's disdain for what he was saying, but how can we demand free speech if we don't practice it? How can we demand respect if we don't give it? So I couldn't agree with you more, brother. Please continue.
Thanks for that, Gerald. One of the more moving and effective actions I saw was on Veterans Day. And there are Native American veterans, and this was sort of an interesting contradiction. I don't want to say contradiction, but there were, I haven't given you much of a visual of the camp. It's probably the one that I was at, the main camp, which is called Ocheti Sakowin, was, it's probably a mile square, just really sprawling in the plains. And all over the place there are flags flying of different Native American nations. And some of them, there are two flags on the flagpole. The top flag is the flag of the Navajo Nation or another Sioux tribe or whatever. And below it is an American flag flying upside down. So there are, you know, understandable attitudes towards what passes for patriotism in this country and its armed forces. On the other hand, there, and everybody respected this as well, there are people who served with pride in the armed forces of the United States. And like veterans everywhere, you know, some now believe they were used and some are still proud of what they did. And there was a very prayerful march up to the place where the National Guard or whoever it was had closed off the highway, and ceremonies there. And what I was going to say was that one of the men who spoke there said, you know, I realize now I was a hitman for Uncle Sam. He had had a long career in the military and named a lot of places that we've attacked and occupied. And he said, and this gets back to the militarization of the police forces, he said, now I see being done to my own people what we were doing to people overseas. Yeah. So maybe people want to know a little bit about, just get sort of a better visual. But Gerald has something to say.
No, I wanted to break it up. Let's have one more song for the day, and then after this one more song, we will. After this song, we will close this out because time is not our friend, okay?
Phone. I'm really affected by the death of Professor Long.
So,
2 o'clock. 6 minutes.
Okay. So, I mentioned that the camp was probably a mile square in this flat plain. It's, by California standards especially, it's a very stark landscape. By the time I got there in late October, all that was on the ground were dry, seemingly dead grasses. There are very few trees. But there are some sort of, you know, here and there off in the distance on a ridge. The landscape is rolling a little bit, though. It's not totally flat. And if you get to a place, you know, just climb up on Facebook Hill a little bit or on any other ridge, there are winding creeks and rivers through the land, including the Cannonball River, which is the one that flows into the Missouri, which the tribe and its allies are protecting. Oh, I've got to say this. One of the most moving moments for me was a day when I happened to be at that open plaza near the campfire, and a woman came up who looked African-American to me and was speaking with an Oxford accent. Turns out she was a Maori tribeswoman from New Zealand whom her people had funded to come to speak their solidarity, to say that they were following this campaign every day, both in their mainstream media, which covered it in New Zealand, unlike here, and their Maori media. And she said that we are now legal guardians of our own river after a struggle of several generations. And that was just, that was so heartening to hear. So anyway, it's flat. The rivers, they don't go straight because they're not in valleys or canyons like here. Well, they don't go straight here either, but they're really winding and meandering and just beautiful curves, and it's big sky country. And part of, I think, what helped me sort of slow down and feel into the connection and spirituality of the moment was being on that land. There is a lot of chaos and a lot of organization at camp. There's a well-organized legal tent, a well-organized medical tent with body worker, women's health, and herbalist subsections. There are, I think, five common kitchens where people just show up at 6 in the morning and start chopping vegetables and volunteer to cook and serve 3 meals a day. Supplies are pouring into camp. Certainly donations, financial donations, would be useful to help buy more firewood and otherwise get ready for the winter. Yeah, that part's scary to me. I'm leaving something else out. Oh, there's a media tent. There's a community meeting in a big geodesic dome that a group called Red Lightning, that it originally formed at Burning Man, came and put up for the camp. And at that meeting, announcements are made about where help is needed. There's a volunteer table where you can say what you can do and what you need, or what's needed for your project. And finally, some white allies who know a lot about allyship and multicultural sensitivity have started holding a newcomer orientation where anybody who's new at the 9 o'clock community meeting is asked to follow these facilitators out. And, you know, we're told things about how to not act like entitled white people or just out of ignorance not respect some of the customs, like don't bring your pets near the sacred fire, things like that. And there's just an incredible amount of hard work happening. Chainsaws going up by the road after somehow a load of logs arrives, and then people haul those down to other places where random volunteers are splitting the shorter logs into firewood. I mentioned the cooking, and there are some construction projects happening. It's a beehive of activity. I need to mention the smells. I came back smelling like some combination of, well, it smelled like bacon, but it's because it was camp wood smoke. With, as I like to say, notes of sage, sweetgrass, and tobacco, which was used a lot ceremonially, and a lot of people smoke it there. The sounds, what did I hear at night? The wind blows there a lot, so the sounds were, and I'm a light sleeper, but I actually grew to appreciate all of these. The flapping of the fabric of my tent and others, the surveillance aircraft overhead, the whinnying of horses. There are horses there and a couple of corrals. And one of the things that was really well organized was security. There were these young men and a few women, too, with walkie-talkies. And when there were actions, they would come galloping up on horseback if things were getting, if it was time to retreat and let people know that. So the wind, horses whinnying, the airplane. And this didn't happen at night too much, thank God, but every now and then somebody would randomly shout out, "Mini Wakoni," which is Lakota for "water is life," which is the main slogan of the action there. And when somebody would shout out, "Mini Wakoni," then shouts of "Mini Wakoni" would erupt from other people from all directions. And similarly, now and then someone would let out a couple of war whoops, and the camp would explode in those, you know, with hundreds of yards in each direction. Very festive and fun. And I'm seeing it's time to wrap up. So I hope I've been able to give something of a picture. It's incomplete, but it's an amazing place. And I'm so glad it's happening and that it's attracting all the support that it is.
Well, I'm so glad that you came here to Slave Revolt Radio at Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 on your dial FM. And also streaming, live streaming on the internet. Just go to Google, put in Berkeley Liberation Radio, and enjoy. And above all, spread it lightly. Talk to your friends. They can't stop you from doing that. Your relations, your fellow students, your fellow workers, they can't take that away from you. Let's cooperate. Let's make that happen. Can I have this for a second? I just want to give a slight review of what we covered today. And I can tell you, we'll have Mike back to talk about, I mean, you know, it's the detail and the feeling that he has conveyed is invaluable. But just to let you know, we did talk about an anti-fascist demonstration, Mike, that was in Washington. We talked about the San Francisco officer that quit. And we talked about also the anti-Trump demonstrations and the court support earlier. That's going to be it for today. And we're gonna take off with this song. And I hope, sincerely, that you all come back next week to join us at 12 o'clock here at Slave Revolt Radio, on Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM on your dial, your FM dial, or you can hear us live stream on the internet.
There's a new and it's just around the bend. There's a new world coming. This one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, and you can hear it if you try. And it's growing stronger with every day it passes by. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a brand new morning.
rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawning that belongs to you and me. Yes, a new world's coming. You know the one I'm talking about, the one we've had visions of, and it's coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in peace, coming in joy. Coming in love. And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is built up the wrath of God. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that have gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God all around them. And welcoming, and it's just around the bend. There's a new welcoming, this one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, and you could hear it if you would just give it a try. And it's growing strong.